Welcome to Death, Lies, and Alibis. I'm your host, Christy, and this is the podcast that dives deep into the dark and eerie world of local cold cases. We're in McConnellsville, a small, lovely town nestled in the heart of Ohio. It's bustling with tight-knit neighborhoods, friendly faces, and a sense of security that you'd expect from any small town. But beneath the idyllic surface lies a hidden darkness, a collection of unanswered questions that have lingered over the years. So grab your headphones, lock your doors, and be prepared to enter a world where the truth has long invaded justice. Hello and welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome. I'm glad you're here. If you're a new listener, welcome. I'm glad you're here, and I hope you stick around till the end. Okay, folks, this is our second episode of the three-part series on the Craig Sirely case. So to get caught up, go back and listen to the first show of Between Truth and Tragedy. So the last time we dove into the life of Craig, who was always a burst of energy wherever he went, and we found a new piece of the puzzle that uncovered his academic journal. He was a proud graduate in electronics from DeVry. And besides his study, Craig was involved in his community, working as a security guard slash attendant at Tapman's funeral home. But his ambitions didn't stop there. He had just been accepted into the police department in Akron. Fresh out of the academy, Craig was buzzing with excitement about his new chapter, eager to start making a difference in his new role. Craig was more than just a vibrant presence. He was a son, a brother, and a creative soul whose death left a void that's been felt deeply by all who know him. The disbelief in the official story of suicide was shared by his mother, Kay, his brother, Kevin, and his little sister, Whitney. And it is still a sentiment that's echoed across McConnellsville. There's a whole mess of twists and turns we still need to get through. So today we're diving back in and tackling the hard-hitting questions that have been keeping us all guessing. All right, so when we left off in last episode, it was 1993, and Craig's family was gearing up for a showdown. It's day two of the trial, and things really started to hit hard. In the courtroom, with every seat filled, the air thick with tension, Kay and Craig's family and friends held on to each other, just bracing themselves for what was about to unfold. They were there for one thing, and one thing only, to unravel the truth about that night, the truth about Craig. You guys, no family should be in that kind of pain, the kind that words can't even touch, the kind that comes from missing a whole piece of your heart. Now, David, that's Craig's dad. He's a tough guy. He had a badge, and he worked on the force for years, and he thought he had seen it all. But nothing, absolutely nothing, could prepare him for this. Staring at those cold, hard photos, the reality of his son's last moments, man, that had to be hard. So, Craig's lawyer started and started shaking things up. That was John Lavelle. He wasn't just there to make a case. He was there to tear down some walls. And, point by point, he took aim at the original investigation, or lack of. Now, Lavelle calls to the stand Janet Cornell, someone who was near the scene that night. Her account added a new twist, making the case even more complex. It's clear from what she saw, we are missing pieces of the puzzle. I have reached out to Ms. Cornell, and I'm waiting for a response back. Okay, let's hone in on the timeline, because that's crucial. We're setting the scene at around 10 p.m., but let's rewind just a smidget back to 9:45. That's when Janet, our witness, spots a truck parked off State Route 376 at those tanks. But here's where it starts getting crazy. The truck's pointed southbound, which is opposite the direction Craig was headed when he was headed out of town. But remember, now, she couldn't identify if it was Craig. She just knew that it was a vehicle and she thought it was a truck. Okay, now we're going to fast forward to the mere 15 minutes there, because that's all we got, 15 minutes. In a blink of an eye, the scenario flips. Craig's truck is discovered, but this time, it's not just parked, it's wrecked, tragically. Craig's found with a life-threatening, altering injuries. And the truck, it's now facing northward, back on the original course that Craig was believed to be taking at first. So here's the million-dollar question. What can really go down in 15 minutes? I mean, you think a lot, but it's a tight window, especially when you factor in the drastic change in that position. And could Craig have really flipped directions, met with whatever, whoever, altered his path, and ended up in that final heartbreaking scene all in a quarter hour? Okay, well, let's see. The truck that was parked southbound, headed back to town, let's say it was our persons of interest, and they flagged down Craig or was waiting for him there. But Craig was shot with his own gun. How did they get the gun away from him? Craig was a big ox. He would fight, I was told. He was a fighter. He wouldn't pick him, but he wouldn't back down. He'd like to end him. Okay, so help us out here, folks. We need your feedback, your opinions, your knowledge, please. We'll post the pics we've got, and you can help us sift through these clues, too. But listen to this. Maybe that truck that the witness saw had absolutely nothing to do with the situation. What if it was there for a completely, totally different reason? Well, I thought of that, but you would think that the person would come forward gladly, tell someone. Or maybe they didn't want to get involved. They were afraid that, you know, McConnellsville being like it was, Morgan County being dirty like it was, maybe they just was afraid to get involved. That's a big possibility. I think that's why it's still cold. People don't want to talk. All right, let's get back to this. Okay, Craig, this is just some information I want to give you here. Craig's blood alcohol content, that's BAC for short, at the time of his death was recorded at 0.182. That's significantly above the typical legal driving limit, which is 0.08 in most states. This would be considered twice the legal limit here in Ohio. But we've discussed this in our Facebook group, and we have a chart with the height, weight, drinks, hours. It's all neatly figured out for us there. And of course, we researched and talked to his friends and family. And this was Craig's normal. He could put away some beers back in. He was a big guy, and it was his normal. That's what he did. He was acting okay as far as that and acting himself. And the reason I bring this up, and I was thinking, well, was the alcohol, would it, you know, help with his, or not help, but it would hinder his thinking or his decisions he's made, his driving. You know, I was thinking how that would come into play, but they said that was his normal. Okay, so, let's go on, because that was the only test they did. And the lack of other crucial tests really makes us wonder what else went down that night. Because if you got any insight, guys, if you know any extra info on maybe the procedures they did follow or didn't follow in this case, or you know why they skipped some tests, I'd really appreciate your insight, so would the family. It could shed some light on this investigation. Okay, because it is crucial that we do try to piece these details together to understand, you know, what happened and why the investigation took the direction it did. Maybe it would help. So we've been led to understand that Craig was driving at a high rate of speed when, according to the reports, he tragically shot himself in the head. Now, this act supposedly caused him to veer off the road, leading to his vehicle, the truck, colliding with a large round bale of hay. You know, those great big ones. And it said this huge bale of hay, that played a crucial role in decelerating that vehicle before it ultimately crashed into the tank. That's why they said it probably didn't bust, because he wasn't going as fast as he would have if he hadn't hit that bale of hay. We'll have the pictures of the wreck, the truck, the bale of hay, the road, the conditions. We'll have that on our Facebook group. Hopefully someone out there can make some sense of this all. Now, Craig was a really smart guy. We talked about his academics. If he truly wanted to end it all, and by all means, I mean this with all due respect, why did he bother with all this? I mean, seriously, he could park somewhere and just do the deed. And please, I'm just talking as blunt as I could, because this is serious. Or run into the tanks, kaboom, it's gone. And that doesn't make sense how he did it, because it just doesn't sit right that he would go at a high speed down the road, because he would be risking and hurting maybe someone else or something else in the process. And that's not lining up with what we've learned about Craig, that he just wouldn't do that. I've never met the guy, but this whole story doesn't make sense of how that went down. Okay, back to that night, Jay Roberts came across the scene that stopped him in his tracks. He's the one that found Craig's truck parked next to the tank, and his parents' property is right across the road there on 376. He said he saw the headlights cutting through the darkness and wondered who was down there. And he went down. As he got a closer look, he noticed a smell, a strong smell, he said, of natural gas and heard a faint hissing sound. The truck's doors, he said, were closed. Now, not wanting to mess with what he said looked like an already dangerous situation, he decided to head back to the house, have his mom call the police. And then he did run back down to the scene to wait for the police. And he said he tried calling out to the vehicle, but no one responded. He mentioned that the truck was already there, like he found it. He did not see it run off the road or anything like that, or nothing else was around. Interesting, though, the story that Jay made to others and what was later said in the Times Recorder, and then later in 1993, an investigation, well, all of those were different. So we're trying to reach out to Mr. Roberts to see if we can clear up these conflicting accounts and get the full story. We're told that he did see something because he had nightmares for a long time, allegedly. Like I said, I've tried to contact him, and I'm hoping Mr. Roberts reaches back out to us soon. So I'm curious, and I think you guys would be too, about the statistics of how many people shoot themselves while driving down the road, folks. All right, on the National Library of Medicine website, I quote, "Only two cases of gunshot while driving an automobile have been previously reported. The author reports two additional cases of suicide by gunshot while driving a motor vehicle has been reported in the last 5 years. Each case was a young man who had been suffering from depression, who obtained a firearm apparently for the express purpose of committing the suicide, and who shot himself while driving a motor vehicle on an interstate highway. Plus, three of the four cases now report each left a suicide note or notes." That's just something for us to put in our little investigation notebooks. Okay, now let's go back to the court proceedings. So when Lavelle had Ronald Frills take the stand, his expertise in forensics shone a light on the shadows of this case. It really did. He talked about the bullet's path, making it clear as day that the story we've been told just didn't add up. Craig and his truck, with that kind of cramped space, no, the pieces just weren't fitting. Now, for all you folks tuning in who might remember the iconic actor Marlon Brando, you'll find this next bit particularly intriguing. Okay, our forensic expert on Craig's case, Mr. Ronald Frills, has a pretty remarkable notch on his belt. He was involved in the 1990, the high-profile case where Marlon Brando's son, Christian, shot his sister's attacker. That's right. It's the same Ronald Fields who's helping us unravel the mystery around Craig's passing long after his own passing. So you can bet he brings a wealth of experience and credibility to the table. Mr. Fields isn't just any forensic expert. He's one who's been in the thick of it with some of the biggest names and toughest cases out there. Okay, so back to the courtroom. So it was all there. Remember the missed gunshot residue test, the fingerprints that were never taken, each oversight a glaring question mark. Before we dive into the next part of Craig's story, though, let's take a moment to unpack some of this forensic details we're talking about and we're exploring here. Understanding these pieces, it's key to putting together what might have really happened that night. Forensic evidence, like the trajectory of a bullet or the presence of gunshot residue, it offers us clues that are silent, yet speak volumes. We call them our silent witnesses. It's these details that can confirm or refute theories, pushing us closer or further from the truth. So let's talk about trajectory. It's the path a bullet takes after leaving a gun. Now, in Craig's case, this detail is a big deal. So Craig's in his truck, and there's this bullet wound on his left side. That's the entrance. Yes, he was left-handed. The bullet's journey didn't just stop there, though. It kept on moving, right? Went through. And here's where it gets wild, though. The bullet had to travel in a certain way to end up where it did. And that path, that trajectory, it tells a story. It's the silent witness to what went down in those silent moments. Now, think about that space inside a truck. Pretty cramped, right? Especially for a big guy like Craig. for that bullet to travel the way it did, certain things just line up, just don't line up. If you're thinking Craig would do this himself, that doesn't line up. It's about angles and speed and all the science stuff that ends up painting a big picture. And with today's technology, we can get this case reopened if it's closed and start testing what evidence is left. As we untangle Craig's story, this bullet's journey stands out. It's a crucial piece of this puzzle. We're dissecting this further in our Death Lies and Alibis Facebook group with diagrams and in-depth discussions. And if you're drawn to the heart of this mystery, join us there for a deeper dive into the evidence and some shared insights. It's where we piece together these crucial details, like the bullet's path, to edge us closer to the truth. We have a picture of the bullet and the gun, and we'll share that with you on Facebook group. Because how he had to be positioned is just, it's just unbelievable. Okay, so because we're talking about a Chevy S10 here, folks. Now, if you know your trucks, you know S10 isn't exactly a spacious ride. It's more on the cozier side. And Craig was a good-sized man, well over 230, and bulky, and over 6 foot. The gun we're talking about, it's not some compact little number. It's huge. We're talking a big, it's 6 to 10 inches of cold steel. With the truck's window rolled up, space becomes more of a barrier. That window, it's just not possible. So when we're digging into this, the trajectory isn't just some fancy word. It is a key piece of this puzzle. It challenges the whole open and shut case theory and makes us wonder what really happened inside that truck. So, a gunshot residue test on Craig's hands, that's forensics 101, especially in this case. That test could have straight up told us if Craig had even fired a gun. But no, nothing was done. It's like they weren't even trying. Seriously, we will address all of that in our last episode. Okay, so Friels, he's not done yet. He calls them out for not lifting a single fingerprint from the scene. I mean, come on. That's back to high school science. But they skipped it. It doesn't add up. I mean, all these missteps, they're just not slip-ups. It's like they're giant red flags. They're just waving around. And it's making the whole thing stink. Allegedly, the truck is still at Brock's, and I have reached out to them in a letter asking for a time and a date that we can go out and we're going to look at it, we're going to take our own pictures, examine it, do some measures, see it with our own eyes. We're waiting for a reply back from them for a good date and time. Now, when they start talking about this and the trajectories and the forensics, the judge starts thinking, what's going on here? He wanted to know about the forensics is why there's no skin tear on the scalp like you'd expect if the gun was right up against Craig's head, like they were saying. That's a big red flag. Brills doesn't miss a beat. He tells it straight. Nothing about this, he said. Nothing says he did this to himself. And that's just right there. You can't say no more, right? Well, we can say more because Craig's got this unexplained blood on his hand. On the left shooting hand, on the palm where he would have held the gun. Not on the back side of the hand, but on the palm where the gun's handle would be. And there's also blood spatter on his left side towards the rear rather than where it should have been straight down. Fields is adamant, saying this isn't adding up to a guy who decided to end things. It's more like someone ended it for him. And there was very little blood in the truck, especially where the bullet exited. That's where it should be. Frill's insights matched what Craig's family had been saying all along, that there's more to this story and it's not as simple as it was first made out to be. The more we learn, the clearer it becomes that solving Craig's case is going to be not straightforward. Absolutely not. Okay, and so on the window side now, the passenger's window side, there was knocked out of its frame and half hanging in the door. And it has a clear, muddy shoe print on it. Clear as day. You can see it. And it was muddy that night. It was in February. It had been raining and snowing. It was muddy out. They did look at the footprint. And I guess it didn't match any that Craig owned. But nowadays, we have a picture of that. We have a picture of that footprint, or excuse me, shoe print. Nowadays, they have a footprint database, like a CODIS database. They have every shoe, boot, whatever. If it's been made, they have information on it. That's another piece of evidence right there. Now, Craig's brother, Kevin, he has a theory, and it kind of sent shivers down my spine. He's thinking that what if that messed up window and everything was all about some fight that went down inside the truck? Now, Kevin didn't get up on the stand to say this, but the idea alone that adds another angle to this. Was Craig struggling with someone in those last moments? And then there's a bit that Kevin shared with me that really makes me pause and think. The gun, the one that ended it all, it was jammed down by the floorboard, right by the pedal. And that's not all. The ashtray was out of its slot, wedged by the gear shift, like someone had put it there on purpose. I've seen the picture. It looks wedged to me. Yes, this could. I think the gun probably could have been tossed around in the wreck. But that ashtray, because Shayla said that she got her ring out of the ashtray that night, and it was in there, and now it wasn't, and it had blood on the underneath side of it. We have pictures. It just does not make sense. Now, if he was going at a high rate of speed, and he did hit that big bale of hay and go airborne and crash into the tank, like I said, I can see where things get tossed around, and, you know, unfortunately, I've been in high speed and low impact, and they're both can be bad. So, like I said, there was blood on the bottom of the ashtray. That was weird because if it was should have been in its place when the gun went off. So this just hints to me that something more had been going on. Please join our Facebook group. Help us out. Examine it yourself. And I just wonder if Craig wasn't by himself, then who was with him? Whose footprint kicked the window out? More importantly, what role did they play in the events leading up to the crash? Was they just a witness that hasn't come forward that's scared? Or were they a suspect? Okay, we're going to take a quick break right here, and we'll be right back, folks. Time to say, I am not a professional anything, guys. I do not have credentials or anything like that. I'm just a podcaster who tells the story. I get my information from the very public records and documents and files that are out there and from many conversations that I have. So please do your own research and form your own opinions. This podcast is to inform, educate, and advocate for justice. Let's talk about a detail that's pretty baffling, as it is crucial. There was bruises found on Craig's right and left shoulders. Now, these weren't just random marks. They were distinct. The kind that, like, tell a story. Another baffling clue. Bruises, as we know, those are another silent witness. They speak of impacts of encounters that leave a mark. And in Craig's case, these marks on his right and left shoulders, I don't know. Let's just question this. How did they get there? What kind of force was involved? And more importantly, what does that imply in the whole scheme of things? And I don't know. Can bruises instantly, as you die, did they pop up? How does that happen? I'm trying to say, were they caused by the wreck, or could they have been old bruises? Was it, you know, a small impact, a jolt? Was it from the steering wheel hitting him?
These are all questions that I'm sorry I don't have answers to yet. Maybe we will. I'm not giving up. It just doesn't make sense to me. Or, you know, it could be a hint of something else, something more, an altercation like Kevin, his brother, said. And another thing, there was only one shoe on when they found him, one shoe on. We have a picture of that. Why would he only have one shoe on? Now, we was questioning why he didn't have a shirt on, and we did find evidence that was documented that was from first responders when they took his shirt off to treat him. But the shoe doesn't make sense, and it says that it was off. So all this evidence, the mismatched footprints, the out-of-place window, the oddly positioned gun and ashtray, the bullet, the bruises, it's stacking up to a story that doesn't quite line up with the idea of Craig being on his own when all this went down. Plus, we have statements from Craig's friends, the people who he was closest to. Their statements about Craig, his relationships, like steroids and things that, quite frankly, made my heart skip a beat. Like drugs, love, lies, manipulation, small town dynamics. Which one? Which one of these are connected with his death? All right, let's go back. Let's go back here a little bit. We're back to the courtroom. And after the gravel hit and the crowd thinned out, it's over. Kay found herself alone with her thoughts, and man, that's when the dam broke. All that strength she'd showed, all that holding it together in front of strangers and lawyers, it just crumbled away. Then, less than 30 days later, there was a court verdict. In a twist that could change everything for the Sierly family, the court came through with a decision that threw a whole new light on Craig's case. They bond and changed the official line on Craig's death certificate. No more suicide label. Now it reads, could not be determined. This shift is like a breath of fresh air for the family because it's a crack in a door that has been shut for a long time. It is a sign that maybe, just maybe, they're on the path to uncovering what really happened to Craig, giving them that sliver of hope they've been holding on to for so long. Whitney, that's Craig's little sister, she sees this as a crucial step toward holding those responsible for Craig's death accountable. All right, so this judge is the judge's ruling. It could have been impossible for the descendant seated either behind the steering wheel of the truck or to the right of the steering wheel in the left center of the seat to have inflicted a bullet wound to his left temple, dying almost instantaneously, and have blood stains on the back of his left arm and the inside palm of his left hand, which would have held the handle of the pistol that fired the shot. Also, the enclosed confines of this particular S10 pickup truck with a standard transmission and modified steering wheel, it would have been impossible for the deceased to have shot himself in the left temple with a weapon with a 6-inch barrel while holding it in his left hand and having the bullet impact in the right rear corner of the cab. Okay, and this kind of throws me off here, guys. Pay attention to this. Although the evidence might exist, there is no evidence in the record which would cause this court to determine that this matter is a homicide or death by natural causes. So, folks, no proof of murder in the record, yet definitely wasn't natural death. So they just need proof, some kind of proof in that record. It is in the conclusion of this court, after hearing and weighing all the evidence and judging the credibility of the witnesses, that Craig Allen Sierly thoroughly died at the time and place mentioned in the death certificate, admitted in exhibit number 4, and that the cause of death was being a bullet wound to the head with sudden onset of death. The court concludes that since death was instantaneous, and since there was no evidence to explain how there was blood on the left leg trouser, left arm and palm of the left hand of the deceased, which would have been holding the weapon. Therefore, it's ordered and adjourned and decreed that the coroner of Morton County cause an amend certificate of death to be issued containing the same information as contained in the original certificate of death admitted as exhibit, for except the coroner shall change block number 33, manner of death from suicide to could not be determined. And the coroner shall further block 33D from self-inflictable to just bullet wound to the head. Now that is huge, folks. That is huge. The Sirely family has never wavered in their conviction that Craig's story didn't end the way it was initially written. Their steadfast belief has fueled a tireless quest for the truth. And this latest twist in the courtroom has marked a crucial point in their fight for justice. Now, back in 93, Judge Favreau took a hard look at all the facts laid out before him. And what he found were gaps and question marks where there should have been answered. The judge's conclusion really hit home on key points. The way the bullet moved and where Craig ended up just didn't line up with the idea of him doing this to himself. It's like physics and the facts were telling a different story from the one that got written down at the very start. For Craig's mom, Kay, hearing the judge's words felt like a huge weight lifted. After all those years of saying something wasn't right, of pushing back against a suicide label, this felt like the first real step towards setting the record straight. And it's not just about what they've been saying. It's about what they've been finding, too. The family's been piecing together more of this case on their own, gathering bits and pieces of info that could shine a light on the whole case. But here's the thing. Even with the judge's eye-opening ruling, there's still no smoking gun, so to speak, that clearly says homicide. It's like we're still stuck in limbo with more questions than answers still. And speaking of a gun, we're still trying to follow that trail on that gun. Was it destroyed or sold? Because there's two different stories goes around. It's evidence and a death. I mean, I can't believe it. It had a lien on it. So it was given back to the loan company. But back in 1993, Mr. Mitchell, remember he was the investigator, he hunted down that gun, bought it back. And we have the claim, picture of the claim ticket that he had. So Sheriff Nelson told a deputy that he put it in the Muskingum River, WTH, I don't know. So we don't really know where the gun is. But so the court's decision has gotten folks in the legal and law enforcement circles talking. And not everyone was on the same page. Back then, Prosecutor Richard Ross, for one, wasn't too thrilled. He was all about letting coroners do their thing without folks second-guessing their calls. Just when you think we might be getting somewhere with cracking this case wide open, we hit another snag. J.P. Lavelle, the attorney fighting tooth and nail for the Sirely family, he had this big idea. He was thinking, why not bringing the big guns, the Bureau of Criminal Investigation, BCI, to really get to the bottom of things? But here's the deal, folks. Turns out that kind of heavy-duty investigation needs a green light from your local law enforcement. And so far, that call hasn't been made. So far, no word from any sheriff's office to bring in the BCI to look into this. Also, dealing with the old sheriff's office was like running in place for Craig's family. Every step forward seemed to get him nowhere fast. But with each new sheriff that came into the office, there was a spark of hope that maybe this time things might be different. Maybe this time they'll get closer to the truth. Now, as we wrap up this part of the story, it feels like we're at a turning point. The court's ruling has thrown everything wide open again, questioning everything we thought we knew about how Craig died. It's more than just a crack in the case, guys. It's a whole door swung open. We're going to invite a deeper look into what really happened. But this is sad and quite frankly makes me mad. The family doesn't know if the case is even closed or open. It should be open because it's undetermined, so it's not a closed case because they have no closure, no answers. The long journey over three decades in the making showcases the incredible strength of the Sirely family. Their dedication to uncovering what really happened to Craig goes beyond just seeking justice. It's about honoring his memory by ensuring that the truth isn't buried in paperwork and overlooked details. I've requested an interview with the sheriff, Mr. McGrath, and also from County Prosecutor Mr. Howdyshell and Mayor Finley. We don't, like I said, we need to find out if the case is even open. We need some answers. Mayor Finley did turn down our interview, but I explained, I just asked a few questions, simple ones. To much to my surprise, he answered these few simple questions. I'll have that on our Facebook group. For those of you who want to dive deeper, who feel moved by Craig's story, the family's relentless quest for truth, well, we've got more of where that came from. Over on our Facebook group, we're sharing articles, records, and all kinds of info related to the case. Also, we have the Death Lies and Alibis Lounge on our YouTube channel, where we're a bit more relaxed. I just have videos over there where we just chill and chat about the case. It's all there to explore for you to join in the conversation, maybe even help shed some light on the unanswered questions that have lingered way, way too long. As we close today's chapter on the haunting and complicated case of Craig's, let's reflect on the journey so far. It's more than just missing Craig. It's feeling lost in a system that doesn't seem to care about giving you one thing you need the most, the truth about what happened. And boy, we understand that here in Muskingum County, don't we? This week, we challenge you to play detective. Based on the evidence we've discussed today, map out your version of events from that fateful night. Share with us. Share your work on our social platforms. Because it's not just about what happened on that dark stretch on Ohio 376 anymore. It's about pushing back against a wall of silence, trying to find a voice in a system that seems all too content and to just let things lie. Whether it's by spreading the word, supporting the Sierley family, or simply keeping the conversation alive, your involvement, it can make a difference. But still, I have some more major questions, and I'm sure you do too. Like, why did Craig run back home and get his gun? Why did he go get his own? And now we hear that there was a phone call that looks like it may have lured Craig out to his death. His mother said in court documents that he received a phone call and left immediately. Now, I'm confused because is that true or is it a combination of Shayla's story or Kay? I don't know. And what led to those haunting personal threats against Craig's family? Because allegedly those threats went way beyond just the immediate family members. And most importantly, what new evidence has come to light that could turn this case on its head? What could be out there that could be tested now that could maybe open this up? Well, folks, this next episode is going to blow your mind. We've been busy and people have been talking. The next episode will be all about theories, all about rumors, and all about the tidbits that we've gathered. And together, we're going to sift through the stories and see what we can come up with. And we're talking about buying steroids out of a nearby gym and that gym being involved in a multi-county drug ring. Also, a white limousine associated with drugs and guns with a mafia house. Or did Craig see or know something about the Sheriff's Department's dirty deeds that they were pulling off in Muskingum County and around other communities? Or was it something so simple as a love triangle, manipulation, and lies? Our interest has peaked, and we're trying to run down some leads. I've got names, and I'm getting more information, so this is getting really interesting, folks. Might have to add another episode to Craig's story. I'm not sure yet. I've sent out a lot of letters to a lot of witnesses, a lot of friends, and I'm hoping to get a response back to them for the next episode. And we will be sharing, like I mentioned, sharing photos and documents and files. So please jump in, tell your friends and family, we need your help. You are citizen detectives, you are armchair detectives, and you are web sleuths, and you're also keyboard warriors. Let's dig into this case. We can't overlook how much we as a community can actually do. Let's show them how much we can do. In McConnellsville, where everyone knows your name and your business, we've got a real shot at cracking Craig's case wide open by just putting our heads together with people coming forward, not being afraid anymore. So here's the deal. If you know something, anything, let's hear it. It could be the break we've been waiting for. And to Craig's family and anyone else out there missing someone, remember this, you've got a whole town behind you. We're all in this together. We're not giving up. All right, folks, that's it for this episode of Death, Lies, and Alibis. We hope that by shining a light on these local cold crimes, we spark something within you, our listeners. Because the truth is, solving these cases will take more than just our words. It's going to require the dedication and collective efforts of the entire community. Don't forget to hit the follow button on the podcast so you'll never miss an episode. To learn more about how to get your cases featured on the show or to get instant access to case files, reports, plus documents, and many, many free resources, go to our Facebook group, Death, Lies, and Alibis, and join today. Or you can email us at deathliesalibis@gmail.com. As always, be safe, stay alert, and never stop seeking justice.